Thank you, Joachim. It's a great honor to be here. I've been invited to the fields, and thanks in particular again to Joachim Martins and David Zing for inviting me and hosting me at UTIAS this morning. So I'm going to be talking about one of my favorite topics, which is smooth optimization, which is also known as also referred to as nonlinear programming. That is just lingo for smooth optimization. And I'm going to be mostly talking about really one major class of algorithms, which we call interior point methods for those problems, but especially for problems that have some degeneracy to them, and therefore, by definition, that pose really threats to the numerical methods that we have at our disposal at this time. So here's an outline of the talk, and I'm going to be going jumping to those topics, maybe not exactly in that order. There will be some overlap, but basically, I'm not sure exactly how familiar the audience is with nonlinear programming. I'm just going to try to explain that everything that really matters in smooth optimization is geometry. And I'll go quickly over a couple applications, mention some challenges. I'll also give a very high-level geometrical view of those famous interior point methods, and then say where degenerate problems come into play. And then I'll describe one particular class of methods that are based on these interior point methods that I'm currently using, and which I call elastic methods, that have proved to be really efficient across various types of optimization problems, really in the past maybe 10 years almost. And I'll apply these elastic methods to three different types of degenerate problems, and hopefully by the end of the talk I will have conveyed the message that these elastic methods are a step towards understanding degeneracy a little bit better, at least some types of degeneracy in optimization. So what is nonlinear programming? Very vaguely, it consists in finding the best solution to a problem, where best is to be defined by the user. It can have very different meanings if you ask different people. And in nonlinear programming, we usually assume that problem data is smooth. And by smooth, we mean that derivatives are known and you're normally able to compute them at least first derivatives. Very often, we also assume that second derivatives are computable, at least in moderate time. I will be assuming in this talk that we have access to second order derivatives, actually we could sort of generalize the ideas a little bit and maybe dispense with those. But we do need first derivatives at all time. So the problems will be written in this form, where we minimize some objective, and these are finite dimensional problems. So we minimize some objective over Rn, subject to two types of constraints, equality constraints and inequality constraints. And in interior point methods, it's especially these inequality constraints that we're going to pay attention to. Those are often those that pose difficulties in the numerical solution of the problem. And the type of problems that I've really been interested in the past few years are problems with a large number of variables and a large number of constraints that do not have any particular convexity properties at all. And therefore, trying to find a global minimizer of those problems is most of the time completely out of reach. So if I find a locally optimal solution, I'm very happy. That's also being very optimistic. To try to find a locally optimal solution. So these are the characteristics of the problem. It is large scale, and large scale is application dependent. It can mean several hundreds of thousands of variables in some applications. It can mean several hundreds of variables in other applications, depending on the sparsity of the problem, the convexity of the problem. These problems potentially have a lot of local minimizers, so we may get trapped in one of those. And realistically, we have to acknowledge that the algorithms that we have are mostly able to find a stationary point, and it's very rare that we're able to guarantee that we're finding even a local minimizer. So why is nonlinear programming useful in practice? Well, I've been teaching now in an engineering school for a few years, and I've been sort of the outpost in nonlinear programming, really, in that school. And I see people from all the engineering departments that come to me, and everybody seems to have an optimization problem. And so people have come to me for image restoration problems, some tomography or MRI related applications, the location of places where to drill for oil, although this type of problem is often non-differentiable. It's a little bit out of the scope of this talk. Some people in the room may be familiar with applications that have to do with this object here. Flying things, the computation of geodesics on strange surfaces such as a donut, the design of structures such as trusses, that may have, for instance, minimal weight subject to some load constraints, or problems that come from, say, optimal control, where you need to command a robot to perform some maneuver, say, in minimum time or with consumption of minimum energy or something like that. So there's applications for everybody in nonlinear optimization, and many problems can be formulated as an optimization problem or not. So I often like to say that all that matters is really the geometry of things to recognize a local optimizer. And when we try to minimize an objective F subject to equality constraints H and inequality constraints C, every optimizer knows that the first order optimality conditions, the Kuhn-Tucker conditions, state that the gradient of the objective at optimality should be a linear combination of the gradients of all the constraints with a particular restriction, the restriction on the sign of these coefficients on the inequality constraints. Those coefficients all have to be non-negative. And on top of this, so this is some sort of conic combination of gradients. And on top of that, these coefficients called the Lagrange multipliers and the inequality constraints have to satisfy this complementarity condition. So at optimality, an inequality constraint is either active, meaning it's satisfied as an equality, meaning we're on the boundary of the feasible set, or else its associated multiplier must be zero. But possibly they're both zero, and that's a source of difficulties. So on a picture, if this is my feasible set over here and this is my local optimizer over there, this top equation here means that I must be able to express the red vector as a conic combination of the white vectors. And that's really all there is to understand one type of degeneracy in optimization. Whether it is possible or not is going to depend on how you write the constraints, how you describe them algebraically, analytically. So the geometry of the problem may be one thing, but the way you write things is a completely different matter. So in some situations, it's simply not possible to express the gradient of the objective as such a combination, even though you're sitting at a local optimizer. Here are very simple examples of feasible sets. here is a problem in two variables that have to be non-negative and subject to this constraint. My feasible set is in there's this shaded area over here. The solution of the problem sits right here. In red is the gradient of the objective, and in blue, the gradients of the constraints that are active at this point. It's simply not possible to express the red vectors, a combination of blue vectors, and therefore, the optimality conditions that I gave earlier are unable to identify this point as a solution. Here's another example of geometry where you have dependent constraint gradients that are actually, they're not only dependent, but they're also opposed in direction, and that causes difficulties as well. So why is nonlinear programming hot despite such difficulties? Well, one thing that I like and that characterizes this field is that there are really relatively few heuristics in the numerical methods that we use. Pretty much all algorithms that are successful in practice are supported by a very strong convergence theory and theoretical property. So we're able to characterize the behavior of the method rather precisely. So they all rest upon solid and well understood convergence theory, and based on that, the implementations that we have for our usage are fast and robust. there's a number of them. I'm going to say a few words about implementations that we have. One important aspect of these implementations is that they're always working in sync with numerical linear algebra. And it's really nice to have a lot of momentum from the numerical linear algebra community to develop efficient methods for linear systems that arise from optimization and the other way around. Also, as I mentioned, there's a host of applications and therefore a lot of energy to spend on numerical methods there. So regarding software in smooth optimization is often structure specific in the sense that you will find software for very specialized classes of problems. There are some solvers that are general purpose, but they're few. And I think being structure specific is really the way to go, especially to solve large scale difficult problems. There's a variety across the grid, really, of a commercial and free to academics and free to everybody software. Most of the pieces of software that are really successful these days are of the SQP variety, the sequential quadratic programming variety, meaning that at every step they solve a simpler problem, which is a quadratic program. Even though those may be combined with these interior methods that I'll talk about a little bit later. So here are a few solvers that you may already, some of you, I know a lot of you use SNOPT. Here, IPOPT is a fantastic open source interior point code. Nitro is a fantastic commercial interior point code, so is Loco. And there are a few others, but really there's a very strong SQP idea behind all of those. They all work very well in sync with modeling languages. There are a few modeling languages that we often use that allow people to describe problems algebraically. Now, those, as I was discussing with Joaquin this morning, those modeling languages may not be appropriate, for instance, for people who wish to solve problems coming from the discretization of partial differential equations, because they only let you express algebraic expressions, not differential expressions. But I think in some time, I know right now there is some effort that is being put into expanding such modeling languages. And there's also a very useful website that is called the NEOS server, where everybody can try those solvers, provided they wrote their problem in one of those modeling languages. So this is a free service that's on the web, actually hosted at Argonne National Laboratory in the U.S. And that is a fantastic online resource that I would recommend to every student and every researcher also to give it a try. One particular piece of software that I've contributed to is called the Galahad Library. Galahad is hosted in the UK, not surprisingly. This is the address where you can check it out. And this is a Fortran 95 library of a set of modules for large-scale nonlinear optimization, non-convex optimization. And I think one of the things that sparked the development of Galahad is the version number 2 of a very well-known augmented Lagrangian code that has been around for a while. It was called Lancelot. And so Galahad is the sequel to Lancelot, but now the library also contains a number of other modules, especially for solving quadratic programming problems, because those are the fundamental sub-problem in our iterative methods. Modules that are able to compute the analytic center of the feasible set if it exists. Trust region subproblem solvers, which is very much used also as a subproblem, and some other methods that are still in progress of the SQP family and regularization, and also other things that are more recent but that are not finalized at the time. So everybody can look at this website. This library is free to academics. And we really welcome feedback on if you give it a try. So I'll talk a little bit about interior point methods now. And this is a topic that I've been looking at really since the late 90s now. And I will dare say they represent the state of the art in the implementations that we have. The numerical methods that we have for general nonlinear programming with absolutely no convexity assumption, but with first derivatives. A few excellent implementations. There is one in Galahad for quadratic programs, and then IPOPT and NITRO are the general case, really. Extremely robust, and they have very strong convergence properties. What we call global convergence, that means identification of a stationary point from an arbitrary initial guess, and properties that are related to the local convergence and the behavior of the algorithm when it's very close to a local solution. So here's I think they're maybe best explained on a picture. And here's a bird's eye view of interior point methods. And I don't really want to go into the gory details of explaining everything about those methods. I think a picture will speak for itself. Here are three constraints. I've drawn them linear just to simplify things, but they could be anything. And they're inequality constraints. So my feasible set is everything that's in here. And the way, we have a local solution X star that is down here in the corner. And the way interior point methods work is they perturb the problem. They're a little bit related to continuation methods or homotopy methods. They perturb the problem by introducing a parameter mu, which is a real number, a positive real number. And for a given value of this parameter, the problem is perturbed and has a local minimizer that is, for instance, over here where this green circle is. And the philosophy of the story is, as you change this parameter continuously, this solution moves along a continuous curve if everything is regular in the problem. It moves along a continuous curve, which I've drawn in red here, which we call the central path because it has certain centrality properties in the sense of analytic centers. And as this parameter goes to zero, this central path leads you to a solution of the original problem. And so the name of the game in interior point methods is to follow the path, is to follow the track the central path. So this is the way it works. Here's an exact solution for a fixed value of this parameter mu, and we decide to solve the perturbed problem to some prescribed tolerance, which doesn't have to be particularly tight because we're still far from the exact solution. So we define some sort of neighborhood around this solution, which is rather loose, and then from a given starting point we perform some Newton-type iterations until we land into that neighborhood. Then we're close enough and we're happy, and we change the parameter to a smaller value which corresponds to an exact solution that lies a little bit further down the path. And we define a slightly tighter neighborhood around that new solution, and from this point where we were sitting, or from another, we start a new set of iterations until we land in the second neighborhood, and we proceed in that way, decreasing progressively this parameter mu as we go, until we decide we're close enough to the solution X star. So I think that's one thing, that's the most important geometrical aspect of interior point methods. And one important thing is that we can estimate pretty precisely the distance between an exact solution, an exact perturbed solution, and the original solution along this path. It is directly proportional to the value of the parameter if everything is perfectly regular. So that is that has important consequences for the behavior of the method very close to the exact solution. And the expected behavior of these methods really in the end is the following. We solve the perturbed problem for a given value of the parameter, and we're over here, we solve it approximately, then we change our parameter appropriately, and a single Newton step is enough to solve the next sub-problem. And then we change the parameter, take a single Newton step, and then what that implies is that we recover the quadratic convergence properties of Newton's method as if we were letting it run free. So that is a really attractive feature of those methods. So people often say interior point methods are feasible methods in the sense that they always satisfy the constraint strictly. There's just a little note to be added to that statement. Very often in implementation, the problem as we've seen it is reformulated, and these inequalities are changed to equalities by addition of a slack variable, and interior point methods are feasible with respect to this inequality. So these constraints may not necessarily always be satisfied, but it is often an option in software to try to attack this problem directly, although it's often quite a bit more difficult. So an individual step of those methods to solve a perturbed subproblem after changing everything to equalities may look like this. This picture is not very impressive for people who work in fluid dynamics and things like this, but this is my equality constraint over here in orange, and at each step methods of the SQP family linearize those constraints, and my linearized constraint is over here in yellow, and one Newton step is often decomposed in two substeps. The first substep is called a normal step, and it aims to improve feasibility, and this is a step that would be directed directly towards the linearized constraints, not necessarily attaining them, but improving on them. And then after that, a tangential step is taken that does not deteriorate the improvement of feasibility that's just been achieved, but aims to improve the objective function. So this first normal step is something like a least squares problem. The second tangential step is really one of the basic subproblems in optimization, minimize a quadratic, which may not be convex, subject to equality, linear equality constraints, and a trust region constraint. So something like that we know exactly how to solve with a variant of the conjugate gradient iteration. So that's one of the modules in Galahad, for instance, is designed to solve just that, because this subproblem is, we come across it very often. So the challenges in those problems are ill-conditioned subproblems, and then some aspects of degeneracy. First aspect, well, at the solution, what happens if it's not possible to express the gradient as the convex, the conic combination of the gradient of the constraints? The necessarily optimality conditions don't hold, and therefore your method will break. Another type of degeneracy I'll briefly talk about is the failure of strict complementarity, and I'll say what it is when I get to it. Just before that, I'd just like to go quickly by linear programming. A linear programming problem looks like this, and since 1985, really, interior point methods have been revived by Karmakar, who has designed a primal dual interior point methods for linear programming, and his rediscovery of those methods have then been carried over to quadratic and general nonlinear problems and sparked a lot of interest and led to the really efficient implementations we have today. Now, one type of degeneracy that occurs in linear programming is when the constraint matrix A doesn't have full rank and has dependent rows. So that poses a problem in interior point methods, because in interior point methods, at least in augmented form, we solve linear systems that have a coefficient matrix that looks like this. It's a block matrix with a constraint matrix and its transpose, and here we have a negative definite diagonal matrix and the zero block. And this matrix is singular if the rows of A are not all linearly dependent. And one technique that's been around for a while, I feel without a proper justification, is to regularize. And regularize mean replace the zero block by a diagonal block that has a parameter in it chosen by the user. And while we're at it, we can also regularize the top block. And the reason to do that is actually not related to degeneracy, but to ease of implementation of the method, really, in the case where not all variables of the not all variables of the problem would have a bound on them. So that's really not the important point. The important point is this regularization parameter here. It turns out that this type of degeneracy in linear programming is curable quite easily, because you're able to choose this regularization parameter completely arbitrarily, provided this number just has to be positive, this delta number just has to be positive. If also you choose a sequence of deltas that converge to zero as the iterations go, then you recover the fast convergence of the normal, the usual interior point method. But otherwise, you wouldn't be able to factor the system. Now, this system is also particularly attractive because I think I have a, this should be a plus sign down here, not a minus sign. This matrix has a very special structure, which is called, it's called a quasi-definite matrix. And even though it is indefinite, it has a Cholesky factorization with negative pivots. And that has consequences on the linear algebra. The factorization is always stable. You don't have to pivot for stability in the factorization of a matrix like this. So you can concentrate on pivoting for sparsity. So the factors the Cholesky factors of a matrix like this one are potentially a lot sparser than the factors of a matrix like that one, which doesn't share that property. So one might ask, well, in linear programming, we usually pre-solve the problem, and so doesn't that remove the degeneracy in the matrix A. Well, I just did this little experiment, and I took about 100 standard test problems in linear programming and gave them to the CPLEX pre-solver, which is, in my opinion, one of the most aggressive ones. And then I compared three methods. Methods where in red I pre-solve and I don't regularize. A method in green where I pre-solve and I regularize. And my favorite method in blue where I don't pre-solve but I regularize, which is the simplest implementation. And this is a performance profile here, and if you're not familiar with performance profiles, let's just say that the higher the curve, the better with respect to this measure. And here on the vertical scale, we have a proportion of problem from 0 to 1. On the left axis, we read, in a sense, the instantaneous speed of one method. So one might say that on almost 80% of the problems, the green method is a lot faster than the other two. And on the right axis, we read the robustness of a method. So we might say here that the blue method solves all problems. And this is in terms of number of iterations, and here CPU time. And so what happens is that I think one of the values of regularization methods is robustness, because this is the only one that solves all problems without exceptions. And those are pretty well-known problems. They're not enormous. They're not the most challenging problems. But I've tried more challenging problems, from fleet assignment problems and so on. I haven't really observed a failure of those regularization methods. Now I'll just say a few words about strict complementarity. I said earlier that at optimality, a solution has to satisfy this strange complementarity condition. And we say that the constraint is strictly complementary if one of those quantities vanishes, but not both at the same time. So it could be expressed like this. Essentially, in terms of the problem, when this happens, it indicates that the constraint is useless in the problem. It's active, but it's useless. So it could be removed from the problem without affecting anything. And on a picture, this is a consequence of failure of strict complementarity. In interior point methods, the central path becomes tangential to some of the constraints, and as a consequence, the radius of convergence of Newton's method for one given perturbed subproblem has to shrink really quickly as we move down this path, because we're not allowed outside of this region. And therefore, that has a direct impact on the local convergence properties of those methods, because the one-step behavior that I mentioned earlier, update the parameter, take one Newton step, cannot take place. And therefore, we don't observe fast convergence on problems that violate this condition. So I think this is essentially what I said. We often observe that the iterates crash into the boundary, the method stalls, because there are logs of those variables that appear in the objective function, and if they crash into the boundary, those terms explode, and it's usually pretty difficult to recover. Here's an example on two problems using the IPOP software. This is the parameter mu here. This is the log of the parameter mu, which converges to zero, and here the last four iterations of the method on this problem, and for each parameter value, we have to do two Newton steps to solve the perturbed subproblem. So that's not at all the behavior that we want to see. And normally, these optimality residuals here should be of the same order as the log of the parameter, which is not the case here. In the second problem, we don't have convergence at all. It's a complete failure. We're unable to make any progress because of this tangential property. However, that does not prevent convergence. It only prevents fast convergence. Now, failure of qualification is a much more serious problem. It says that the conic combination cannot take place. So we can't use our usual optimality condition, and that has an important impact on the linear algebra. So most techniques propose modifying methods, modifying SQP in particular, but the one I'll describe briefly now is sort of self-contained and is able to deal with problems that do not satisfy a qualification condition. And I recently found that it is also able to apply with no changes to what I call structured degenerate problems, such as problems with complementarity constraints and vanishing constraints. The idea is this: we take our problem and then we apply the classical L1 penalty function to it. And this yields this penalty function, which is non-differentiable, so we don't like it. But then we add artificial variables T and S to describe these absolute values and these max terms, and we reformulate those absolute values like this and these max terms in this equivalent way, and then plug that into the expression of the L1 penalty by adding those terms as constraints. And what we end up with is a different problem, is a penalty problem. It has a penalty parameter in it, and it has only inequality constraints, and has very important properties. It's as smooth as the original problem. It always satisfies a constraint qualification, so it's never degenerate. It only has inequality constraints, and therefore it's well suited to interior point methods. Now, there is something like that in SNOPT. It's called elastic mode. These extra variables are called elastic variables. And in SNOPT, elastic mode can be activated at the quadratic program level when a quadratic program is infeasible. But really this idea is coming from a 1976 paper from Main and Polak. So the outline of the algorithm, I don't want to go into too much detail. These are the optimality conditions for the perturbed problem. This is my parameter over here. I have tolerances that describe my neighborhoods that converge to zero. I just don't want to go too much into that. And my penalty parameter is up here in the gradient of the Lagrangian. Let's see. I think I can safely skip over this. An important aspect of the method is how we're going to update the penalty parameter. A crucial aspect of all penalty methods is how you update the parameter. So typically, its role is to attain feasibility. And therefore, when you don't make enough progress towards feasibility, you're going to increase your penalty parameter. That's the basic philosophy. And the method converges under this sole, very general assumption. But we're going to obtain much stronger results if we also pay attention to what happens to the Lagrange multipliers. And if the Lagrange multipliers differ too much from the penalty parameter, we're going to increase the penalty parameter. Why is that? That's because we know that if the original problem was degenerate, then the penalty parameter will have to explode. It will have to go to plus infinity. And the Lagrange multipliers will explode at the same rate. And therefore, you want to keep things in sync. So the convergence properties of this method are the following. This is quite classical. If the penalty parameter is updated finitely many times, then you identify a first-order stationary point of the original problem. Now, the interesting situation is what happens if the penalty parameter explodes. Well, two things can happen. Either you diverge completely, or you converge to something, or you have a limit point, say. If you have a limit point and it's infeasible, then it proves that your problem is locally infeasible, in the sense that you have a stationary point for a measure of infeasibility. So locally, you can't make any progress towards the feasible set. If your limit point is feasible, and I think this is one of the strongest convergence properties we can obtain in the general nonlinear non-convex case, if the limit point is feasible and the penalty parameter explodes, then we have a certificate of degeneracy of the problem, and we've identified a point where the constraint qualification is not satisfied. And more precisely, we've identified a point that satisfies an equation like this, where these are the Jacobian matrices of the equality and inequality constraints, and these things are not quite Lagrange multipliers, but scaled Lagrange multipliers. And what this equation says is not all multipliers are zero. And those that are non-zero are directly pointing to constraints that are to blame for the degeneracy. And therefore, that's an indication on how to maybe modify the problem and remove this degeneracy. So there are other methods in the literature that have an elastic mode, as I mentioned, such as SNOP, but also others. So I'll just go, how much more time do I have? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? So I'll just go over two applications, say, of this elastic framework, the two classes of problems which I called, which are always degenerate, and which I call structured degenerate problems, problems with complementarity constraints and problem with vanishing constraints. The first class is the problem of complementarity constraints, are problems that can be, that have constraints that can be written in this form. The only important constraint here is the last one, where x1 and x2 are two subvectors of your variables, two subsets of variables. So the min has to be equal to 0, meaning that both have to be greater than 0, so they're bounded below, and component-wise, at least one of them has to be 0 at the solution. So the feasible set of a problem like this is composed of two half axes, which are the dashed axes on this picture. Now, when we take this problem and immerse it in the elastic framework that I just gave, we add those elastic variables that have the effect of enlarging this feasible set, and that's why the problem is never degenerate. And when I look at what happens in the X space, the elastic problem has a feasible set that looks like the shaded region, and this is only in the X space. There are other dimensions to this and the elastic dimensions. Many problems in game theory can be formulated as problems with complementarity constraints. It's all coming from Stackelberg games, really, at the beginning. But also, some bi-level problems can be formulated as MPECs, except that we have to keep in mind that people who work in bi-level programming are often looking for a global minimizer. And in bi-level programming, we may find a problem like this by replacing the inner or the slave problem by its first order optimality conditions, which is going to have the complementarity conditions that I've mentioned earlier. So we know that those points violate every constraint qualification at every feasible point. Nevertheless, they admit Lagrange multipliers, so it may be possible for our methods to identify a local solution of those problems. However, we see in practice that they often have lots of difficulties. But there has been quite a bit of study of those problems, and especially some work to develop tailored constraint qualifications for those problems, and therefore tailored optimality conditions. And what's really amazing is that with absolutely no changes, the elastic method that I've described is going to target those specialized optimality conditions without any change to the method. So that is, I'll say, an application maybe to MPCCs. There has been previous work where people enlarged the feasible set. In fact, that's one of the main two classes of methods for problems with complementarity constraints. But in most methods where the feasible set is enlarged, it's enlarged manually. It's enlarged by way of parameters that are controlled by the user. A major difference here is that these parameters are my elastic variables, which are essentially controlled by Newton's method. They're automatically updated for me. Now, others have used the L1 penalty to solve MPECs, or MPCCs, and elastic mode has already been explored for MPCCs. The novelty here is that the same method applies to both classes of problems, structured, degenerate, and general, without any modification. So there are essentially two ways to formulate these complementarity conditions. We still have to formulate them in a smooth way because I'm assuming all my data is smooth. So one way to formulate this complementarity condition is to ask that both variable be bounded below by zero and that component-wise their product be zero. So this capital X1 here is just a shortcut. It's a diagonal matrix with X1 on the diagonal. So this just means the vector of products x1i, x2i must be equal to zero. That's what I call the equality formulation. The inequality formulation is similar by requiring that these products be non-positive. So this is perfectly equivalent. So, and then you can take any of those two smooth formulation and then immerse that into the elastic framework. So here's some results on a set of test problems with complementarity constraints, which is called the MacMPEC collection. It has about 144 problems, and I've only retained here the equality form of the smooth formulation because I found that was the one that was performing much better. And here are performance profiles again. And my three curves here are simply three variants in which I update the penalty parameter slightly differently or I initialize it slightly differently. And we can see that that can have a dramatic impact on the overall efficiency of the method. So even though the theory is rather clean and clear-cut, and implementing those methods is not at all obvious, at least implementing them in a way that is really efficient. So the conclusion from this graph is that we solve here approximately 85% of all those problems with a pretty straightforward implementation of the elastic method. And by absolutely being careless about the fact that there are complementarity constraints in there. There is nothing special that is done about those complementarity constraints. So this is at variance with other methods that you will find that have something that's called a complementarity constraint mode. And so you have to activate that mode or deactivate it yourself. So there is no such thing as an MPCC mode in the elastic method. A second class of example, and I'll finish on this, is the class of problems with vanishing constraints. And those are problems that really arose from truss design problem and people working in structural and topology optimization. These are not as degenerate as problems with complementarity constraints, but they're known to violate various constraint qualifications at various places in the feasible set. Like MPCCs, they admit multipliers nevertheless. They have a specialized Taylor constraint qualification. And amazingly, again, the elastic method is able to target the specialized optimality conditions that follow from the specialized constraint qualification. Now, one might ask what the reason for that flexibility is. I believe it's the L1 penalty method, but but I can't, at the time, I can't really justify it thoroughly. So when we talk about vanishing constraints, I've represented the feasible set up here. This is an anglerfish, and the feasible set of problems with vanishing constraints is always composed of one body that has an interior, and then some kind of antenna that springs from it. So the anglerfish describes pretty well the problems with vanishing constraints, and very often the solution to the problem lies somewhere in this antenna where all constraint qualifications fail. So that is the difficulty with those problems. There's been quite a bit of work actually very recently, because they've been introduced in this paper from 06, optimality conditions and constraint qualifications for those problems have been introduced. But in the past, people have been manually enlarging the feasible set as for complementarity constraints, and people who were very active in structural optimizations are trying to give alternative formulations. I forgot to mention, the reason why they're called problems with vanishing constraints is that we have a bound and a subvector here of x. x1 must be larger than 0, and then these products here have to be less than 0. And when x1 is strictly positive, then this second constraint imposes a sign constraint on x2. But when x1 is equal to 0, then this constraint disappears completely, and we're in the antenna. There's no more sign restriction on n2, and so one constraint vanishes. So as I was saying, the body of work for vanishing constraints is following quite closely the development of methods for problems with complementarity constraints, because they're so similar, and it's especially active in structural optimization community. So the new results that come from the elastic method are direct parallels of those I've mentioned earlier. Under this tailored constraint qualification, we can prove the set of optimal Lagrange multipliers is non-empty and compact, which is a usual property in optimization. That's something we're looking for. If the penalty parameter remains finite, then we identify a first-order point with respect to a specialized optimality condition. If the penalty parameter diverges and yet we attain feasibility, then we've proved that the problem was degenerate. Well, we already knew it was degenerate, but now it's degenerate in a much stronger sense. It's degenerate in the sense of the tailored constraint qualification. So that is that is a byproduct, excuse me, of the elastic method. So I'm not aware of any other method that has an elastic mode for such problems, and I think this is the first one. Although I have to mention, people in structural optimization have been using SNOT for quite a while to solve those problems, and maybe have been wondering why SNOT has been doing so well so far. Well, probably it's because it has an elastic mode hidden somewhere deep inside at the quadratic programming level. Unfortunately, there's no standard test set in existence to my knowledge, so that is something that we would really need to be able to validate numerical methods here and practical problems. So talking about numerical validation, I have a prototype implementation of this elastic method in this Python development environment for nonlinear programming. That is freely available on the web. There is also one that is a little bit more suited to extreme programming, say, in Galahad. Problems for both of those can be modeled in the CUDA environment or in the AMPL modeling language. Those are two of the modeling languages that we have, and they're available on a host of platforms and a host of computing environments. So I should conclude. I've tried to describe a unified treatment, a method that is able to put together degenerate problems, whether structured or not, without any changes to the method proper. Under the hood, there is an interior point, a primal dual interior point method, which is, I think, responsible for much of the efficiency of the method, and it is able to produce a certificate of degeneracy in case things go wrong. But it's an intelligent certificate of degeneracy that is able to tell you what is causing degeneracy. So there's quite active research in degenerate programming now. There has been for maybe 15 years, maybe more, but very active for about 15 years. I think there's still a lot of challenges to go for. One of my goals in the near future is to examine what happens in the elastic method when strict complementarity fails. What are we able to do in that method to still recover fast local convergence and be able to sort of process those two types of degeneracy in a unified way. So I think we don't have the ultimate optimization method yet, but I think now I understand a little better why SNOPT is doing so well on so many degenerate problems, because you can feed MPECs and MPVCs to SNOPT and it's doing quite well. So we have fast software, but when it comes to degeneracy, we really have to improve on robustness, and I think that is the goal of all the the aspects that I've mentioned today. So I'll end here, and thank you very much for your attention.
So we've got time for a couple of questions.